Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up, everyone? Happy New Year and Happy New Decade. I am pumped to get 2020 kicked off by announcing a couple of new educational collaborations to add to our current array of TWIML community programs. The first of these starts next week. We are super excited to be collaborating with research scientist and instructor Robert Ness to bring his core sequence, Causal Modeling and Machine Learning, to the TWIML community. Causality has become a very hot topic in the ML and AI space, but there are relatively few instructional resources geared towards data scientists and ML developers. Furthermore, this is the first time we'll have the opportunity to host a course's instructor leading a study group on our platform, so this group should be a ton of fun. The study group will meet at 8 a.m. U.S. Pacific time on Saturdays, and to get things kicked off, Robert and I are hosting an overview session next Saturday, February 1st, at that time. Another hot topic in our community is ML and AI platforms, and more broadly, strategies for efficiently developing and deploying machine learning and deep learning models inside the enterprise. I've hinted at this next study group before, and I'm mentioning it again now since we're getting close. I've partnered with IBM to bring the new IBM AI Enterprise Workflow Specialization, a six-course certificate-granting sequence recently published on Coursera, to you, our community. I'll personally be taking this course sequence and hosting a study group for those of you who'd like to join me. If you're doing, interested in, or would like to learn more about data science, ML, or AI in a real-world enterprise context, I'd encourage you to check this one out. I'll be hosting an informational session on the course in early February. For more information on or to join either of these programs, visit twimlai.com/learn2020. And now, on to the show. Hey everyone, I am here in Vancouver for NeurIPS, continuing our conversations with some of the researchers that are at and participating in this amazing conference. And I've got the pleasure of being seated with Yannis Born. Yannis is a PhD student at ETH in Zurich and the IBM Research in Zurich. Yannis, welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast.
Thank you so much, Sam, for having me.
Why don't we start out by having you share a little bit about your background? You're coming at things from a cognitive science perspective, but your poster here is on reinforcement learning. You know, how did you get interested in this field and how do all those threads come together?
Right. Yes. So you're right. I'm having a background in cognitive science and in computational neuroscience. And so I've been like focusing on brain research for my past 5 years of education. And now recently, I've been doing more work on computational systems biology and specifically on cancer and cancer, trying to understand mechanisms of how cancer work and how we can find new treatments against cancer specifically. And in this work, I've been using mostly deep learning techniques. And this will be part of like my presentation here at this conference also. And so, yeah, so how do those things go together? So I think like many people think it's in a way weird if you come from brain sciences and then you go into machine learning, right? Mm-hmm. And this is something where I would say it's like, it's a very obvious thing to do in a way, because if you look back into the history of machine learning, where it all came from, like McCulloch and Pitts, the first artificial neuron, and then a few years later, Frank Rosenblatt, the perceptron. And so these were all computational neuroscientists, and they were in the end really trying to understand how the brain works. Mm-hmm. And they basically developed the fundament of the field of machine learning. And so at some point, this community then, in a way, it split up into two groups. And one group was more trying to actually understanding how the brain works. And the other group was more interested in solving the problems, right?
Right.
And
right.
from this community, the machine learning community evolved into. But whereas computational neuroscience right now, it's still a field, it's still out there. It's separating more and more from the machine learning community, but it's still out there. And originally it has been one big community.
Yeah.
And so therefore, like, I think it's quite natural to have this process.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think particularly here at NeurIPS, I have the opportunity to speak with many folks that are kind of working on that edge of cognitive sciences, brain sciences, and both using that to inform the way we think about machine learning, using machine learning to validate, you know, some of the biological theories. You know, what's maybe more novel is coming from cognitive science and brain science and applying machine learning to developing cancer pharmaceuticals. How did that come about?
Yeah. How did that come about? It's a good question. So, like, if you look at brain sciences, there's really this problem of seeing the brain, which is arguably the most complex thing we have in the universe, and seeing, like, observing this brain and trying to understand this brain from at different, like, scales, at different spatial scales, so to speak. So you can think about the brain in a very abstract and in cognitive ways, thinking about cognitive phenomena like language and memory and those things. And you can think about it more from a neural perspective. Like, how do actually, like, what is the most fundamental unit of information processing? How do these units interact? How does information arise? And so, like, these are two fundamentally different approaches. And so in the first 3 years of my studies, I focused on cognitive science, which has more this top-down approach, like thinking from the big concepts and then down towards the implementational level. Whereas computational neuroscience, they have more like this bottom-up perspective. Mm-hmm. They, in the end, they're trying to solve the same problems, but they start first with the basic building blocks, like having a biologically plausible neural network model that imitates basic behavior of neurons, and then they try to scale it up in order to understand more complex cognitive phenomena, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, these two fields, they help each other, and they need to work together in order to better understand how the brain works. And so after my undergrad studies, I really had the feeling, okay, I need something more solid, and I really wanted to have this bottom-up perspective from computational neuroscience, which then mm-hmm. I got in my master's. And so afterwards, I had to say that I was keen to explore applications of machine learning, because while studying the brain, I got really interested more and more into the whole field of data science and machine learning. But mm-hmm. and I wanted to apply those techniques, but at the same time, I wanted to still somehow work with a human body and with humans in general. So this is how I came about doing cancer drug modeling.
And so the poster is titled Pac-Man. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Pac-Man.
Yeah. So Pac-Man is a frame. I mean, it's an acronym. So spelled with a double C and double N. So it's an acronym. We came up during my about a year ago during my master thesis. For prediction of anti-cancer compound sensitivity with multimodal attention-based neural networks. Mm-hmm. And so, when my supervisor came about with this acronym at one of the very long nights we spent in the lab, we're like, okay, there's no discussion. This is going to be the name for the project. So quite funny how this came about. So, and what we're doing in this work, that was the first step of the project I'm presenting here at the conference. We were trying to basically forecast the effect, inhibitory effect of a molecule against a specific type of cancer. And so we are treating this problem of predicting cancer drug sensitivity really as the property of a pair. And the pair is composed of the molecule itself, the chemical, the drug that you give to the patient, mm-hmm. and then the particular tumor cell that you want to target, mm-hmm. because cancer is really it's a family of diseases, and it is so diverse. I mean, there has probably never been two types of cancer that have been exactly alike, because the cascade of mutations you have, they vary heavily in between of every individual patients. So it's really unfeasible to try to investigate whether a molecule has some anti-cancer effects in general. So you really need to treat this problem as the property of a pair. So is this drug, has it an inhibitory effect against this specific type of cancer in this patient individually?
One of the questions that comes up first for me is, one of the techniques you're applying here is reinforcement learning. How does that play into achieving that goal?
So it comes about in the second step. So the first step was really just trying to predict the sensitivity, so the efficacy of this of a drug. And so what we did in a consecutive step after we had like built this model, what we asked ourselves was like, wow, wouldn't it be amazing to have a model that can generate new drugs, right? Mm-hmm. And that can like come up and propose new anti-cancer candidate drugs. Because in the whole pharmaceutical industry, there's a huge productivity decline in the last few decades. And the estimated costs that you have per new drug, they're estimated to be $2 to $3 billion. And most of these drugs that are then like FDA approved and approved on the market, so they're really specific only for like very few types of diseases or even one disease only.
Right.
So the cost in R&D that go are like spent in this business, it's just huge.
Yeah.
And so we came up with this framework where reinforcement learning is really core component, where we're trying to design anti-cancer drugs specifically for individual patients or groups of patients. So we're trying to envision a precision medicine perspective here, where we're not trying to generically come up with new anti-cancer candidate drugs, but we try to, like, in the design process itself, we try to tailor the molecule, the drug, specifically to the need of the patient himself or herself. Mm-hmm. And so for this framework, we use a reinforcement learning regime.
Okay. You also mentioned in the title of the poster, transcriptomic data. What is transcriptomic data?
Right. So you can think about transcriptomic data as basically the expression of every single gene that you have in your body. Like you know about the human genome. And so parts of the human genome encode for specific proteins. Mm-hmm. And these expression of these proteins you can measure in the cell. There's different techniques to do that. So the most commonly used technique and the technique that was used to measure the data we work with is called RNA sequencing data, mm-hmm. where you measure basically the mRNA snippets in the cell. And so from this, you can infer basically which genes were expressed to what extent. So you end up, if you do the sequencing step, you end up with a vector of about 20,000 genes. Mm-hmm. And for each gene, you would have an expression value. This is usually just an integer, like how many times did you find this the snippet in the sample. And then so this this vector, you can really think of it as like a fingerprint of the cell. So it's a proper characterization of the cell. There's a different types of omics data. So this is transcriptomics data, right? There's like also genomics data, which directly measuring gene data. And there's also a proteomics data where you actively measuring the proteins.
Proteins. So starting from that first step, you're kind of starting with trying to predict the effect of a drug on the cell. Is it, is this a supervised learning type of a problem that you, is that the way you've framed it?
Yes. This is supervised learning. So it's a regression problem in the end. It's quite simple in the fact that we're really trying to predict a single property, and this is the IC50 value. So this is the micromolar concentration of a drug that you need in order to kill 50% of the cells. So, and this is the thing you're trying to minimize. So if you have a smaller concentration of the drug, then this drug is more effective, right?
So your training data comes from measurements that have been done applying different types of drugs to different types of cells?
Exactly. So there's huge databases for this problem. So the two we are working with are GDSC and CCLE. These are standard databases in the field, and they usually don't work with patients directly because you can't try like several hundred drugs on the same patient, right? But they work with so-called cancer cell lines. So these are abstractions. These are cell lines that have been growing in the lab in petri dishes for quite some time, and you apply these drugs, to these cancer cell lines. Mm-hmm. So these cell lines have been taken originally at some point from humans, but they have been growing in the lab for a long time,
right.
And there have been mutations induced downstream. So they are proxies of real cancer, but it's an active field of research to whether or not and to what extent they're proper mm-hmm. Proxies.
Yeah. And so in the creation of this data set, somebody carefully administered small quantities of these drugs and noted the point at which half of the cells were, or just over half of the cells have died off. And that's the proxy for the efficacy of the drug.
Absolutely right.
Yes. Okay. And so you built a model to predict the performance of new arbitrary drugs. Right. And how do you kind of featureize the drugs?
Right. So that's a good it's a good question, because in the end a drug is a molecule, so this is a graph, and mm-hmm. graphs are rather difficult to represent in a deep learning regime. So what traditionally has been done by chemoinformaticians about a few decades ago is they would derive molecular fingerprints. So these are binary vectors, and in these binary vectors, every item would basically specify the presence of a certain feature. And this was completely handcrafted. So one feature could be like, do I have X aromatic rings in this molecule or not? Something mm-hmm. like this. So, but this is a very arbitrary and handcrafted representation of a molecule. Yeah. And the field of deep learning has been moving forward. So one great thing that deep learning really brought to us is like advances in natural language processing, mm-hmm. right? So, and a different representation of a molecule can just be a text representation. So mm-hmm. there's a certain languages, the most commonly used language is called SMILES, and SMILES is an inline notation of molecule, mm-hmm. Of molecules, where you would basically write down a list of atoms and bonds. So you think about the molecule in a as a graph, and then you do a traverse through the graph, and mm-hmm. you denote step by step the atoms and bonds.
Kind of like a much more rigorous approach to saying H2O for water.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And this is the type of representation we're working with at the moment.
Oh, interesting. So you've totally skipped the accepted formalism and are primarily working with this natural language approach. What's the thinking behind that? Is it that the natural language has more expressiveness somehow than the binary representation, or is it something else?
So, one thing that's great is that it is much more, it is closer to the actual representation of the molecule. It is much easier to understand for any chemist. Any chemist can look at this SMILES notation and can understand the molecule, can draw the molecule, whereas this does not hold for a fingerprint. Another advantage of SMILES is that it enables data augmentation. So data augmentation is commonly used everywhere in deep learning, like images, you make rotations, whatever. Mm-hmm. So what you can do is, apparently, if you think of a molecule as a graph, there's not a single graph traverse, right? But you can start at different points
exactly. And take different routes through. Yeah.
And then you would get the atoms and bonds would be the same, but the ordering would be different, and you would get a different text representation, right? And
this Whereas on the fingerprint, theoretically, they should all resolve to the same fingerprint.
Absolutely, they do.
Okay.
They all resolve to the same. So you have a unique representation for the molecule in the case of a fingerprint, whereas in case of a SMILES, you can really exploit this SMILES augmentation, basically, mm-hmm. by exploring different graph traverse in order to augment the performance of mm-hmm. your
model. Better generalize.
Yes, it will okay. generalize much better. And so the advantage of working with text really is also that you can more or less directly transfer all of the advances of natural language processing, mm-hmm. Like attention-based models, which, by the way, are absolutely great because they leverage interpretability methods. So, attention, this super commonly used technique in NLP, right, where the model really highlights only specific parts of the input sequence in order to, produce the next output token, for example, in a language translation task, right, or in order to produce a prediction. And so we can also leverage these techniques into our model. And this is great because you can understand the reasoning of the model post hoc, basically. Mm-hmm. So what we can do with this model is we can understand that the model came to a specific prediction because it was focusing on a specific substructure of the molecule, right?
Okay.
And then we can check in the literature, is this like a known substructure? Is it known to have certain chemical properties? And in this way, we can validate the performance of the model.
Okay. Now, others doing similar types of applications have taken, you know, whatever their input domain is and kind of projecting it to like an embedding space and finding related molecules in that embedding space and then using that to identify candidate, you know, materials, I think is the example that I'm thinking of. Is that something that you've looked at as well?
Yes. So this comes about in the drug generation part, which is the second part of the project.
Okay. Where
we're trying to design new cancer drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're doing there is we use deep generative models, specifically variational autoencoders. And what is really awesome if you're working with variational autoencoders is this property of the latent space and the fact that like similarity in this latent space, which is in a way the embedding that you generate for a specific input, in our case a molecule,
mm-hmm.
that similarity in this latent space will correspond to a structural similarity of the molecule if you decode the points in the latent space.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like
it the seems, drug molecule in this case.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I mean, it seems like a super natural property, right? You would expect this that similarity in this latent space, although it is hidden somewhere in the network, it will resemble something meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently, this is not necessarily the case. So you have to specifically enforce this with specific constraints that you have to apply during training this model.
Okay.
But this is like the core property of variational autoencoders, but this doesn't come along naturally, basically.
It's not for free. You have to figure out what the relationship is between two drugs that causes them to have a similar effect on the target molecule.
Yes, in a way.
Or the target cell.
Yeah. So, I mean, what you can do, and this would be a pure chemistry model. This doesn't necessarily need to have anything to do with cancer or with drugs. It can be the same way for materials, like all kinds of chemicals, basically. So what you can do, for example, is you have a certain point in the latent space. You decode a molecule from it. It is some kind of molecule. Let's say it's aspirin or so, right? It could mm-hmm. be. So, and then you take a different point and you decode from there. And let's say you get paracetamol, right? And then what you can do is you can, in the latent space, you can traverse, you can basically make a walk, like a walk from this point of paracetamol to the point of aspirin.
Mm-hmm.
And you can decode intermediate positions and you will end up with molecules that are in a way intermediate mixtures in between of aspirin and paracetamol.
Yeah.
So, and this is it's a super nice property for everybody working in drug discovery because you can much better explore the chemical space. And so this is something that, I mean, it's not obvious, but it is extremely important to have better models and techniques to explore the chemical space. The size of the chemical space, it is about 10 to the, it's estimated to be around 10 to the 60 molecules.
Mm-hmm.
So this is massive.
Mm.
The amount of atoms in the universe, I'm not sure, it's like a few orders of magnitudes higher, but it's not crazy.
Right.
I think it's below 10 to the 100. I would need to look it up.
Mm-hmm.
But so, and you need to have techniques to navigate this space meaningfully, specifically at a time where we have generated and synthesized already so many compounds, like I think it's in the order of 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 that have ever been synthesized and tested.
Mm-hmm.
But it is completely unfeasible to just continue like a random sampling process.
Right.
And therefore, you really need to have this guided sampling and guided navigation.
Kind of going back to that phase two of your project, you are applying you mentioned a generational or generative rather model as kind of an intro to where the reinforcement learning comes in. What's the connection between those two?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the part of the project where I'm really most excited about
uh-huh.
is about generating new drugs. And so not so much the whole prediction model that I've been talking about before. So what we're really trying to do there is that given a transcriptomics profile of a cancer patient, so this can a theory work in the following way, that you have a medical doctor making a biopsy from a tumor cell. Mm-hmm. This biopsy is then sequenced. You get the gene expression. This is the transcriptomics data. You put it into the model. You have a variational autoencoder for this cell profile, so only for the transcriptomics data. You encode this transcriptomics data into some latent representation.
Right.
And then in this latent space, you fuse together a chemical, like another variational autoencoder. So it's really like a combination of two variational autoencoders. One is for chemistry, it's just for pure chemistry and molecules. And the other one is for cell profiles, specifically cancer cell profiles and transcriptomics data. Mm-hmm. You fuse together the latent embeddings of these two models, and then you decode from there a molecule. And how you can use this model is really by you can feed it a cancer cell profile from a patient, and it will propose you an anti-cancer drug. Mm-hmm. So originally, like in the first place, this will be like a random molecule.
Yeah.
But, and now the reinforcement learning comes into play. What we can do with this molecule is we can plug it into the prediction model that we developed in the first step.
Right.
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 So in the first step, I said we have this prediction model that takes has two inputs, namely a molecule mm-hmm. and a cancer cell profile, and it tries to predict the efficacy of a drug. Right.
So this is kind of providing our scoring function
exactly.
for the RL learner.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
So we use this prediction model to get a reward. And then this reward is used in turn in order to update the generator. Mm-hmm. And then we have a closed loop system, which we can train with a policy gradient and reinforcement learning techniques. And then on the long run, we can, we've shown quite consistently, we can like propose molecules that have a higher predicted efficacy according to our prediction model.
The two variational autoencoders, are those trained independently or are they trained end-to-end somehow?
Yeah, so they are initially pre-trained completely independently.
Okay.
So you can really thinking about these autoencoders as learning completely disentangled representation. So one is really for molecules, just to understand this SMILES language notation,
yep.
to understand how chemistry works in a way. And so the other autoencoder for the transcriptomics data, so this is just trying to approximate and learn the space of possible cancer cells, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So these are pre-trained independently. And then what we do is really
Is that second one, so it's creating the representation of the cancer cells. And then there's a decoder step that's taking these two and coming up with a prediction of a drug molecule?
Yes. So there's a decoder that basically combines the two latent representation mm-hmm. of the cell profile of interest and a drug, and then comes up with a new cancer drug.
So and how's this one trained?
So this is trained jointly in this reinforcement learning.
Okay, regime. So it's part of that reinforcement learning circle. Got it.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's important to note here is that it's highly non-trivial how you combine these different data modalities. It seems extremely arbitrary in a way to fuse latent representations of a molecule with the latent representation of a cancer cell profile. What we're doing there, it is, just the first thing that came to our mind is we're summing up the latent representations. Mm-hmm. But because we are doing this consistently while we are being in this reinforcement learning regime, we think that we can basically warp this latent space representation from originally encoding structural similarity between molecules, right? I was talking before about morphing aspirin into paracetamol, right?
Right.
So we can morph this latent space into encoding functional similarity. And functional similarity, I mean different similar functional properties of the molecule, so that you have a certain subset of the space, and in this subset of the space, you will find molecules more frequently that have high predicted anti-cancer effects, basically, according to our prediction model.
Do you or have you come across research that looks into the, you know, algebraic combinations of latent spaces and how that, you know, what the right intuition is there. Mm-hmm. Are people, you know, how much has that been studied? Have you come across stuff?
I mean, to the best of my knowledge, it's something that is not very, very actively studied. So there is a paper from Neurips from 2 years ago called Deep Sets, and they are talking about how to deal with sets data. Mm-hmm. And what they're proposing
I'm asking you in part because this is my second conversation today where someone said, oh, we just sum up these two latent spaces and that's what we use to...
Right. I mean, I was today at a poster session and I talked to somebody who was doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, I told him, honestly, this is kind of an arbitrary choice. I'm doing the very same thing in my work. I'm just interested... Uh-huh. Do you have a better justification for it than I do, right? So, I mean, in a way, what they propose in this deep sets paper from 2 years ago, where they're talking about how to deal with sets in a deep learning framework, is that you need to have a permutation invariant operation in order to combine sets. Because the thing is, with sets...
That was really the justification that was given to me in the previous conversation.
Right.
It kind of eliminates the role of order.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The order doesn't play a role.
Right.
So this holds for many operations, right? It holds for the for an averaging, for a sum, for many others. But so like the sum is something that we came up with, and it is an obvious choice. But to be honest, to me, in a way, it still feels like we're mixing apples and oranges a bit, and I'm not super satisfied with how we're solving this part of the
framework. Also losing information in the process. Just like if you were to do an average, there's unique information that you're just kind of throwing away.
Yeah, there's information being lost. And there's a paper also, like I saw another paper where they've been at this conference just yesterday, where they've been looking into different ways of combining latent spaces. And so they proposed, I think, three ways. One was just like a uniform sampling. So you would basically have a mixture of both. So you would sample like from a uniform distribution between 0 and 1. Mm-hmm. And then you would say, okay, I weight the one representation with 80%, the other one with 20. And so I just have a weighted average, basically. Mm-hmm. So another thing they proposed was a Bernoulli distribution, where you would basically pick, like the latent representation is it's an embedding of a certain amount of dimension, right? It's a vector of a certain length. And then you can say for every dimension, you pick either one or the other. And you do this according to Bernoulli distribution, and then you have a mixed representation. Or the third thing they were suggesting is like a learned embedding, basically, where you have a specific, a few dense layers of a neural net to learn this embedding. So, but still all of these, they didn't seem specifically instructive to me, but rather like, okay, you can do it this way or this way, and we can check what works best, and we see empirically this works best, but it wasn't super, they didn't provide a great justification for it. But still, I'm curious and to try it out, and this I will definitely try it out.
Any particularly interesting observations in training the DRL learner to solve this problem? Is it kind of similar, to other use cases, or were there specific things that you had to do here to get it to converge?
So it's an actor and critique framework, so to speak, where you have the actor is this conditional drug generator that comes up with a new compound, and the critique is the separately pre-trained this prediction.
Running it through this prediction thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and you can assess other properties of the molecules as well, right? So because this predicted property, this IC50, it's not the only property qualifying or disqualifying a molecule for being a drug. Mm-hmm. So there's also other things like water solubility is something that's extremely important. Or
will it kill you?
Or cytotoxicity is a common thing that you have a drug that is generally so cytotoxic,
it will just kill everything,
right? So, and then it doesn't help either.
Right?
So, and there's many of those things that you really need to incorporate, and then this reward function for the generator can become very complex, right? Because you need to trade off what is more important. Do I weight solubility higher than cytotoxicity, or how about synthesizability of the molecules? Some structures are just extremely difficult to synthesize, and although you can draw them on the paper, you cannot really make them chemically in the lab, right?
Yeah.
So this is another thing.
And presumably so, that's all future work. And right now you're focused on performance relative to this predictor.
Right. So this has been the first step, just performance relative to the predictor. We have the framework now there with all these like a panel of critiques, so to speak, to evaluate other chemical properties. Mm-hmm. This is something that is commonly studied or has been commonly studied to train generative models to come up with molecules that fulfill specific chemical criteria. What's really novel about our work is this bridging drug design and systems biology, basically, where you leverage biomolecular information, in this case of the cancer cell, into the design process directly. Mm-hmm. And this is something that like has never been done in any way. Mm-hmm. And this is what distinguishes our work from like a lot of what is happening in the computational chemistry domain and the drug discovery domain. With respect to your previous question about reinforcement learning, so one thing that happens commonly in generative models is this mode collapse, where basically you are generating only a single element that can, in a GAN setting, for example, can really fool the discriminator very well, but you lose the variety of the samples that you're generating.
So kind of a form of overfitting.
In a way, absolutely, exactly. Because the model, in a way, it learns, okay, I have this specific instance and it works super well, so I just always go for this one, right? So why should I explore something else, right? And it makes a lot of sense to behave in this way. So, and this is something we also observed in the fact that the model we had, it tend to like produce long carbon chains. And for some reason, these carbon chains, they, under some circumstances, had the property of having a high predicted efficacy according to our prediction model, but still we know that they can't, they don't really qualify as actual drugs. And so this was one of the challenges we were facing. So with respect to the results, what I'm most impressed by when I look at this, and what really surprised me, what I didn't expect when I started working on this, is that the model comes up with, they really resemble closest with the known anti-cancer drugs that are known to work for this type of disease. So what this means is that we train the generative model to design a new lung cancer drug. We eventually arrive at a new compound and we check the chemical properties of these compounds, and we see, okay, from all known cancer drugs, we can measure the similarity, and we see it's not most similar to any kind of cancer drug, but is most similar to known approved lung cancer drugs. And we have the same result for breast. We generate a new drug against breast cancer. We check the database of known cancer drugs. We check which molecules are most similar by like a nearest neighbor search. And we find the nearest neighbors of this new drug cancer, new breast cancer drug, are actually approved breast cancer drugs and not cancer drugs.
And is this nearest neighbor search in your latent space, or
this is nearest neighbor search of the fingerprints of these molecules?
Okay.
So, because on a, like, again, if you take the SMILES notation, you cannot really compute a nearest neighbor in between tags, right? Doesn't make sense. So we compute the fingerprint first.
Okay.
And then we make a nearest neighbor search there by Tanimoto similarity. This is like the standard metric to use in this case. And they are, again, what we find is that the molecules we generate, they seem to be closest to known cancer drug, cancer drugs that are approved for this specific site of cancer and not anything else. And this, in a way, it shows us that we're on the right track, and that in a way the model understands that a lung cancer drug should have different properties to a breast cancer drug.
Nice. And so in terms of your qualitative results and metrics, how are you approaching that?
This is extremely difficult in the sense that the actual validation for such a framework is to test it in the way that you synthesize the drugs that the model comes up with.
Right.
And then you run screening tests, and you try to basically start the entire pipeline of clinical trials. And this is something we're working on at the moment. So at IBM, we do have options to synthesize molecules, and this is something we're starting to do, but at the moment we are looking for collaborators when it comes to the experimental validation, because this is a skill and expertise that we do not have in-house. Also, we don't have the equipment in-house to run these assays, But therefore, we are at the moment we are actively seeking for collaborators to work with us together to run these drug screening assays to basically, like in a petri dish, measure what's the efficacy of this drug.
You know, taking a step, you know, back to the evaluation criteria we were discussing earlier, is that something that is automatable? Like maybe the better way to ask the question is, in your training loop, what do you use as like a loss function?
Mm-hmm. So the loss function is, because it's reinforcement learning.
Well, this is the actor critic thing.
Like the reward is coming from the prediction critic model that we have. I mean, what Pacman really tries to do is it tries to run this drug screening assay for you.
And so it's
it tries to run it in a machine as opposed to you have to do it by hand, right?
Right. So it's spitting out these candidate drugs that pass its test of, you know, being able to fool, you know, the critic or, you know, pass your predictor model. And then you're manually kind of comparing these to other known drugs for similar types of tissue for kind of a qualitative sanity check? Or is that, have you integrated that into the training process somehow?
Mm-hmm. So it's all integrated in the training process in the way that if you train long enough, you see that the model, like with a high probability, comes up with a drug that has a high predicted efficacy, which means it passes this drug screening assay, this virtual drug screening, it performs very well.
Yeah.
And it has chemical properties that are desired, basically. So it is more or less easy to synthesize it. It has the right amount of water solubility, all of these properties.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but then what we do is like we store those molecules that haven't basically passed all of these tests.
Mm-hmm.
And then post hoc, what we can do is we can then look at these molecules together with a chemist.
Yeah.
And then check whether it is feasible to synthesize them. And because this is like, I mean, it's another set of problems. Like, how do you synthesize a molecule?
Right.
So there's
right.
a whole active field of research on retrosynthesis, right? Just trying to basically decompose the target molecule that you want to have into the reactants and reagents you need in order to get and arrive at this molecule.
Right.
Right. right. And this is like, I mean, it's a huge problem by itself. So you really need to have this like recipe of basic ingredients that you can purchase anywhere in order to arrive at this new compound that probably has never been synthesized in the world before.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, Yannis, thanks so much for chatting with me about what you're up to. Very cool stuff.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. To learn more about today's guest or the topics mentioned in the interview, visit twimmelai.com/shows. For more information on either of our new study group offerings, causal modeling and machine learning, or the IBM Enterprise AI workflow, visit twimmelai.com/learn2020. Of course, if you like what you hear on the podcast, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.